Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
It's Here and Now. A second Iraqi woman has come forward with claims that Iraqi soldiers raped her. The Associated Press reports that the accused soldiers have confessed. Meanwhile, the Iraqi government has announced plans to sue the first woman who said she was raped, accusing her of fabricating the story. Both allegations by Sunni women have led to student protests and angry criticism of the Shiite-led Iraqi government and have cast doubt on the government's new security clampdown. On the line from Baghdad is Mohammed al-Dulami, an Iraqi special correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Mohammed, what are Iraqis saying about these allegations and the government response, particularly response to the first rape claim, the one the government says didn't happen?
Ma'am, the Sunni community here in Baghdad is really going more angry day after day. We have a government that formed a committee within 4 hours, released the results, and they said they're going to reward the soldiers. And as a matter of fact, it's a record time, 4 hours. So everyone thinks that there is something is going on. If she wasn't raped, definitely she has bruises all over her body. So there must be a trauma. So at least if they investigated in that bruises thing, not the rape, instead of honoring these soldiers immediately.
Well, both of these women made their allegations on television, which we understand is highly unusual in Iraq. It would be, frankly, highly unusual in many countries for women to come forward and say that they've been raped. There's so often a stigma attached to that. But what has this done? What are people saying? What has this done to ordinary Iraqis?
It depends on what sect you are. You really see the division among Iraqis. You will find a Shia who's supporting the government, and he's trusting the government 100%, and he will dismiss this incident as something didn't happen, you know, at all. And then if you're a Sunni, the Sunnis are believing everything that goes against the government. So it depends. But it is also showing us the Iraqi society is dividing more and more day after day after each single incident.
How likely is this division going to provoke more Sunni-Shiite violence?
We saw it yesterday. We are predicting that the insurgents group, along with the terrorist groups like Al Qaeda, will try to portray themselves as the protectors of the women honor in Iraq, especially the Sunnis. We're afraid over here that the terrorist groups will take advantage out of these incidents to fuel insurgency with more recruits.
Mohammed, this week in the U.S., a U.S. soldier testified in court about participating in the rape and murder of an Iraqi girl. Some would say, as awful as that story is, that with a large population of people, there are sadly bound to be rapes. Are there other allegations, you know, against any kind of soldier, Iraqi or American, that we're not hearing about?
Yes, ma'am. From October last year till February, we have 6 allegations of rape. These low-profile allegations are being withheld from media because the families don't want to be shown on media. It's a very sensitive issue here.
Mohammed, you say that there are other allegations and that Sunni clerics convinced this 20-year-old from Baghdad to come forward with her story. But I'm wondering, have you and other journalists formed an opinion about her?
We think the government released 1 page of 3 pages of a report to hide something. If it wasn't rape, there must be something else that will affect that woman's life and her family to generations to come. So there must something happen that the government is not saying.
Would you trust a trial to get to the bottom of this?
The problem in this country we have now is our establishments, none of them, even the judicial system, is being bipartisan or neutral. So I don't think this issue will ever be solved I think the Iraqis will believe what they like to believe. And this is how it is in our society now. And I'm sorry, because this is a fact.
Muhammad al-Dulaimi, he's an Iraqi special correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers in Baghdad. Well, a new study says the war in Iraq is creating terrorists out of foreign fighters who will then pose a new threat when they return to their home countries. The study comes to the conclusion Iraq war critics have been making for some time, that the war is actually causing terrorism rather than stopping it, as the Bush administration has argued. The lone bright spot, some success fighting terrorism in Southeast Asia. We'll have more on that later in the program from Black Hawk Down author Mark Bowden. But first, we turn to the co-author of the terrorism study, Peter Bergen. He's a research fellow at the Center on Law and Security at the New York School of Law and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. And by the way, the study appears in Mother Jones magazine, and you can read it online at our website, here-now.org. But Peter, first to you, you crunched numbers here. What did you find?
We found a sevenfold increase in attacks, a sharp rise in the number of fatalities. Now, of course, a lot of this is happening in Iraq, a good deal of it's happening in Afghanistan, but we also found enormous decreases around the Arab world, places like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, real increases in amongst our NATO allies, for instance, in Britain, Spain, and Turkey. The only place where there was some good news was in Southeast Asia, where we found a pretty precipitous drop in jihadist terrorism. But that's really nothing to do with the Iraq war. That's stuff that's really local to that those set of jihadist disputes in Southeast Asia.
We'll be reporting on that. But another positive finding of your study, you write, is that only 18 American civilians, not counting civilian contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan, have been killed by jihadist groups since the war in Iraq began. Some would point to that as proof, as the Bush administration said, that this is, you know, keeping the terrorists there and not here.
The way that we did our studies, we compared the period immediately after the 9/11 attacks up to the invasion of Iraq, and then compared it to the invasion of Iraq up till September of 2006. And in fact, between 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq, only four Americans were killed by known jihadist terrorist groups that we could find. So the Iraq war has really made no difference to the issue of their ability to kill Americans. The reason that al-Qaeda has had less of an ability to kill Americans is that they've been somewhat damaged. The United States is much more secure. The American Muslim communities rejected the al-Qaeda ideology, etc. But certainly in terms of our allies, the Iraq war has increased jihadist terrorism. And the reason that's a problem for us in the long term is that when we get attacked again, we're likely to be attacked by somebody holding a European passport. You may remember in summer of 2006 an attempt to bring down 10 American airliners with liquid explosives. Well, the guys involved in that were all British citizens, pretty much, mostly of Pakistani descent. These guys weren't distracted by the Iraq war. They went ahead with a plot that would have killed thousands. Mm. Luckily, it didn't work out because of cooperation between Pakistan, Britain, and the United States.
You quote, in fact, the head of Britain's M15 is talking about the sort of exporting of terror from Iraq to Britain and exported on the Internet.
Yeah, well, clearly, the guys who did the London attacks in July 7th, 2005, they said that Britain's role in the Iraqi attack, when they did the suicide, so-called suicide wills, which they videotaped, they pointed to Britain's role in the coalition in Iraq as the reason for the attacks. Now, our article is not making the absurd argument that the Iraq war causes terrorism. We were attacked on 9/11 long before we were in invading Iraq. What we're saying is that it's much amplified the problem. And the place, I know Afghanistan quite well, been visiting since the mid-90s, and that, is quite striking. There was really no suicide terrorism in Afghanistan when we first went in there in late 2001. It only really began after the Iraq war happened. And basically, the jihadists in Afghanistan learned from the Iraq war. They both copycatted from the Iraq war. And also, there's some suggestion that people from that region traveled to Iraq to learn about IED techniques, etc. And certainly, there are Arabs in Afghanistan conducting suicide operations at this point, because we have videotapes of these attacks. So the point is that the Iraq war has had a pretty strong influence on what's going on in Afghanistan. We've had, by the Pentagon's own account, suicide attacks numbering 27 in 2005, going up to an astonishing 139 in 2006. So you've got exponentially rising numbers of suicide attacks. So what is happening in Iraq has radicalized a new generation. That's according to the U.S. government's national intelligence estimate that was partially declassified in October of 2006. What we've done is we put some flesh on the numbers behind the national intelligence assessment. I think we brought sort of a certain amount of clarity to the debate by sort of saying, okay, well, let's go to the numbers.
Well, you speak of suicide attacks, and you mentioned Robert Pape. We had Robert Pape on this program many times. He wrote the paper Dying to Win, and his definition back in 2005 of people who would undertake suicide attacks were people who were nationalists, who wanted foreign invaders out of their country. You say that that's changed. That definition of a suicide attacker has changed primarily because of the war in Iraq.
Pape has done some valuable work, and I think what he said is, look, religion is not as important necessarily as sort of nationalist impulses. But his book was sort of dead on arrival in a sense, because right as it was being published, the Iraq war really started, the suicide attacks started taking off. And the people who are conducting the suicide attacks in Iraq are not nationalist Iraqis. There are very few suicide attacks are conducted by Iraqis. There's been a raft of studies to demonstrate that these are largely people from around the Arab world, but also including some Europeans. I mentioned in the piece we wrote, Muriel de Gork, who's a Belgian female baker's assistant, 38-year-old. She conducted a suicide attack in Iraq in November 2005, along with her Tunisian-Belgian husband. So the point is that religion is motivating these people. It's not just sort of a nationalist struggle. The people who are coming to Iraq are motivated by the idea that the Muslim community is under attack and we need to get involved.
Well, you know, you mentioned Muriel de Gork, and it is a fascinating story, this 38-year-old Belgian woman who detonated a bomb as she drove past an American patrol. And she is used as an example of what a researcher you quote calls the globalization of martyrdom, this, you know, this idea of Iraq bringing in foreign fighters willing to martyr themselves and inspiring people, for instance, in London willing to martyr themselves. But, you know, as I look at that, I think, is maybe Muriel de Gork just a woman who had a horrible romantic notion, you know, followed a man to this? Does she really represent anything other than herself? I mean, can you really show that there were that many other Muriel de Gorks?
She is unusual, certainly female suicide jihadist recruited by al-Qaeda in Iraq. But by the way, there have been other female suicide attackers recruited by al-Qaeda-like groups recently. For instance, in Egypt, we've seen this, and in Kashmir. But I agree with you. She's sort of an outlier. But A, the number of suicide attackers is pretty low in Iraq. But B, they've had a huge strategic impact. And most of them are foreigners. They're not Iraqis. They're drawn principally from the Arab world and also increasingly from North Africa. We had a piece in the Washington Post just in the last day or so talking about Moroccans being recruited. We had a piece in the New York Times the same day talking about Tunisians who are being recruited in large numbers. And also we're seeing this in Europe. One of the studies we cite of the 101 identified suicide bombers in Iraq, seven of them came from Italy. Now, they're not necessarily, you know, native Italians, but they are North Africans living in Italy who may have residential status or may even have become citizens. And so, you know, as the Iraq war, you know, will continue, I think, for whatever the United States does is going to continue in some shape or form for many years to come. And it's going to continue drawing in jihadists from around the Muslim world. And not all of them are going to, you know, die in Iraq. Unfortunately, they're going to learn some skills that would be applicable to attacks against Arab countries in the future, European countries in the future, and of course, eventually, the United States, which remains the main enemy.
Well, we want to hear more about that, because your study does leave us with this disturbing image of these foreign fighters now in Iraq, returning home to their countries or coming here to the U.S. We're speaking with Peter Bergen of NYU's School of Law. He's also the terrorism analyst for CNN and co-author of a new study on terrorism that's been published in Mother Jones Magazine. By the way, you can read that at our website, here-now.org. After a break, more with Peter. Also, this reminder later today, water, water everywhere except on distant planets. The search for life in outer space is coming up dry. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Peter Bergen, co-author of a new study on terrorism that's published in Mother Jones Magazine. It shows a sevenfold increase in terrorism since the beginning of the war in Iraq. But, Peter, perhaps your most disturbing finding is the one at the end of the study. After you lay out your theory that the Iraq war has drawn in foreign fighters, you raise an image, you call it a blowback of fighters with new skills then going home.
These guys are not going to go home to open falafel stands and coffee shops. I mean, they're going to be the new sort of shock troops of the international jihad. And we've already run the videotape once before with the Afghan war. The blowback from that war was the first Trade Center attack in 93, the embassy attacks in 98, the USS Cole attack and 9/11 itself. Why would the Iraq war be any different in terms of the blowback? In fact, I think it could be much worse for two reasons. One, the kinds of things they're doing in Iraq are much more applicable to acts of urban terrorism than the Afghan Arabs around bin Laden who are fighting the Soviets in a kind of conventional guerrilla war. These guys are doing suicide attacks, they're doing IED attacks, they're doing urban warfare. And also they're fighting, instead of fighting the Soviets, with one of the worst armies in modern history, they're fighting two of the best armies in world history, which is the U.S. military and the British military. So these guys are going to be battle-honed, they're going to swap business cards, they're going to learn some skills, they will have bragging rights, and they're not going to suddenly change their mind about the United States. And the other thing which I think is very problematic is that al-Qaeda in Iraq is also becoming a much more Iraqified organization. According to some U.S. government officials who follow this, who I've talked to, that 90% of al-Qaeda in Iraq are now Iraqi. I mean, there are a lot of people who want to take revenge against the United States for what we've done in Iraq. We may also face not just sort of foreign fighters who are veterans from Iraq, we may also find Iraqis who want to come and take revenge against the United States. And we're not going to be able to exclude all these people over time. I mean, eventually somebody's going to get through.
That becomes even more disturbing when you write that in 2002, al-Qaeda was sort of on the ropes. They were sort of a faltering organization before, as you said, the war in Iraq gave the group new life. But I just want to, touch again on these returning fighters. You write, Jordanian intelligence sources say 300 fighters have returned to Jordan from Iraq. German, French, Dutch intelligence officials are estimating dozens of their citizens are returning from Iraq. And Saudi Arabia in particular is concerned about this, what you call blowback.
According to the most authoritative study of the makeup of the foreign fighters in Iraq and the suicide attackers, about 40% of them are Saudi. Now, those numbers may be going down because the Saudis are trying to clamp down on this problem. There may be more North Africans. The New York Times article I referred to earlier talks about 600 Tunisians who have tried to go or have gone to Iraq. There have been a number of Saudi clerics have sort of encouraged young Saudi men to go and fight. I think the Saudi authorities are rightly quite concerned because when these guys come home, they regard the House of Saud as much as an enemy as the United States government.
Well, Peter, given this thinking, what do you think? Should the U.S. stay in Iraq and risk attracting more jihadists or leave Iraq and risk that the fighters who were there would then spread out around the world?
A complete withdrawal, in my view, would be to snatch a total catastrophe from the jaws of an enormous blunder. So what I'm saying may be appearing slightly contradictory. Certainly the Iraq war has re-energized the jihadists, but unfortunately now we're in the position we're in. The worst thing we could do is allow a sort of mini Afghanistan to appear in central and western Iraq, which, by the way, is already beginning to happen. According to the U.S. Marines' own assessment of Anbar province, it's now run by al-Qaeda in Iraq. The strategy of the jihadists is to create a mini jihadist state in central western Iraq from which they can launch other attacks against the United States and its allies. We simply cannot let that happen.
That's Peter Bergen, research fellow at the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law and senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Again, co-author of the new study on the globalization of terrorism. It's published in Mother Jones Magazine, and you can read it at our website, here-now.org. And as he mentioned, one of the success stories discovered in his study is in Southeast Asia. Well, Mark Bowden of Black Hawk Down fame writes about one of those success stories in The Atlantic magazine. He tells the story of how in 2002, the Philippine Marines, with the help of the CIA and the U.S. military, cracked the terrorist group Abu Sayyaf and killed its then-leader, Aldem Talao. 3 months before 9/11, Talao kidnapped three Americans at a tourist resort. He killed one and dragged the other two, a missionary couple, around the jungle for a year. Philippine Marine Colonel Juancho Saban describes the tactics his men used to get close to the terrorists.
Marine intelligence is based on relationships. That is so because we don't have that much funds to shell out to informants. What we do is we befriend the people.
We befriend the people. We asked Mark Bowden about the importance of this operation.
Well, to me, it's a very good illustration of how I think the United States ought to conduct itself in this war on terror, and that is by realizing that local forces have far better capabilities of gathering intelligence and operating effectively in their own territory, and that we are in a position, because of our superior technology and wealth, to provide significant assistance to our allies. And I think the nature of the terrorist threat is small local franchises of jihad that are, you know, coming together in various places around the world. And to the extent that we can be involved without leaving a large footprint, I think our efforts will be much more successful.
But aren't forces trying that on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, for instance? And perhaps Talal, a two-bit thug, you know, might be one thing, but if you have someone like Osama bin Laden, who others are following for maybe different reasons, you know, reasons of ideology, that's a little harder.
Well, it's definitely true. I mean, different situations present different challenges. But I think in the hunt, for instance, for Osama bin Laden, there somewhere on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, I think the problem has been finding local authorities who are willing and capable of tracking him down. And I think what the CIA did in the Philippines was sort of wait until they were able to determine which element within the Philippine Marines was likely to be the most effective. And so they didn't go to the, you know, to the most powerful or the most influential branch of the Philippine military. They went instead to the one that they felt would be the most effective. And I think that was an intelligent approach that might have some application in other parts of the world.
That's author Mark Bowden. His article, Jihadists in Paradise, appears in the current edition of The Atlantic magazine. We'll take a quick look ahead at tomorrow on Here and Now to ask, what's behind this new chill between the U.S. and Russia? Also, Tom Perata, he's author of Little Children. His adapted screenplay is up for an Oscar, but we're going to ask, who are we supposed to like in this dark tale of suburbia? That's tomorrow. Funding for Here and Now. Astronomers from Harvard and MIT have announced they've made the first detailed measurements of light from planets in distant solar systems. The results are surprising even to the astronomers. Here Now's Alan Cockle explains why.
If you could stand outside in the middle of the night, not here on the East Coast, but say down in the dark desert somewhere in Arizona, you could look up and with a good pair of binoculars, right near the Dumbbell Nebula, you could just faintly see a star. A star with the evocative name of HD 189733. What you could not see is the planet orbiting this star.
What we'd like to do, of course, is just to take a picture.
Dave Charbonneau of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics says a picture of the planet would show that it's giving off heat in the form of infrared light. This light would reveal the composition of its atmosphere.
So, for example, if you were to look at the Earth, if you were to put on your infrared goggles and stand out in space and look at the Earth, you'd be able to tell, of course, that there's lots of oxygen and nitrogen, some methane, and, of course, some carbon dioxide. You could learn a lot about the atmosphere.
An Earth-like signature would suggest life. Unfortunately, the planet orbiting HD 189733 is much too far away for a direct picture. So the astronomers used NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope. Think of this as the Hubble telescope's infrared cousin. When the planet was behind the star, they measured just the light of the star. Then, as the planet circled towards Earth, they measured a bit of extra light. As they report this week in the Astrophysical Journal Letters, that extra light was the light from the planet. There was just one problem.
What we were expecting was to see lots of water.
Charbonneau believes this planet is a gas giant like Jupiter. And like Jupiter, it should have lots of hydrogen and helium and also other molecules, including oxygen. And if you heat an atmosphere like this, you get water.
So we looked very, very carefully and we saw nothing, no water. And that was the big surprise. In fact, we didn't see evidence for any molecules of any kind.
While that seems strange, another study this week also failed to find water in the atmosphere of a distant Jupiter-like planet. The second set of results is published in Nature. Sarah Seeger of MIT was part of the team.
And the fact that we don't see water doesn't mean the planets don't have water.
Seeger and colleagues looked at a different planet, this one orbiting HD 209458, a sun much like our own. She says the measurements were good, but something seems to be hiding the water.
Like, for example, it could be hidden by clouds. Think about it like, you know, when you go on an airplane and you go through the clouds, if there are clouds up and you can't see the ground, you can only see the clouds, right? And there's that whole atmosphere all below the clouds. You can't see that. So it's possible that in a sort of similar situation, this planet has a lot of clouds.
Indeed, Sarah Seeger's group found hints that the planetary atmosphere could be full of dust, silicate dust that might be masking whatever's below. The astronomers say the most important thing is that for the first time, they've actually measured light from a planet in another solar system. Dave Charbonneau hopes that in the next few years, astronomers will be able to measure many more planets, including rocky planets like Earth. And this will let them search for those telltale signs of life.
It could be that there are many, many habitable planets out there and that life is common. Or it could be that there's something really unique about the Earth. But what's exciting is that for the first time, we're going to have the ability to answer that question.
Of course, all this assumes that life in other solar systems is more or less like life here on Earth. Charbonneau admits that's a bad assumption, call it Earth-no-centrism, but it's a big old universe, he says, and you've got to start somewhere.
Here now is Alan Cockle. For more on the search for life beyond Earth with cool pictures, go to our website, here-now.org. Well, we have a little time now to open the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. And we heard from many of you after we spoke with Dr. Janet Wozniak of Massachusetts General Hospital here in Boston. She authored a study in the 90s that led to a dramatic increase in the number of young children diagnosed with bipolar disorder and often treated with antipsychotic drugs. Virginia Diaz of Portland, Oregon, reflected many of your thoughts when she wrote, "I was outraged at the fact that there's no mention of maybe looking at the home and parenting skills of the parents before drugging the children. Also, doctors need to look at a child's nutrition. I think educating parents would eliminate a lot of the bipolar diagnoses by doctors and parents." Well, Dr. Richard Goldwater, a psychiatrist from Newton, Massachusetts, agreed that problems at home could cause emotional problems in kids. He also feels psychiatrists are too quick to find biological reasons for trouble in children.
Present-day psychiatrists are not particularly well-trained in family therapy, let alone individual therapy. And so they will naturally hope to find that there are biological reasons for what they treat.
But Deb Hom writes, "Your story on bipolar disorder made me weep. Our son, who's 28, was diagnosed when he was 17, but we sought mental health care for him when he was 2. Our family lived in a war zone for 17 years. If medicines had been available then, we would not have hesitated to have pursued them. It's an insult and a disservice to all families that struggle with this issue to minimize it by saying parents are trying to quiet an unruly child. Our son was hospitalized with a suicide attempt at 17 years old. Thank God they're continuing to research meds for kids with bipolar disorder. I wouldn't wish our life experience on anyone." Well, yesterday we reported on a kerfuffle over the children's book, The Higher Power of Lucky, in which a dog gets bit by a snake on the scrotum. Now, the book has won the prestigious Newbery Medal, but some librarians won't carry it because of that word, scrotum. Well, Pamela Bronson of Upper Darby, Pennsylvania writes, "I think the brouhaha over scrotum is silly. We are a conservative Christian family with high moral standards, but our kids have known that word from little on up. What I really want to know is, did the poor dog live?" Yes, Pamela, he did. Well, Barbara and Peter Linson of Portland, Oregon, wrote after we spoke with Professors V. Bode of Boston University about retirement savings and mentioned a Wisconsin University study that said people born between 1931 and 41 had saved enough. Well, the Linsons wrote, "The people born in the midst of the Depression and World War II are super savers. More interesting would be to look at the difference between that group and later generations who have only a sliver of the discipline they did." You might remember we spoke recently with Jane Mayer, a staff writer for The New Yorker. She reported on a meeting between a West Point dean and producers of Fox TV's 24. The dean asked the show's writers to cut back on the use of torture in the show because students and soldiers in the field were imitating what they saw. Well, Kathy Schalk of Marblehead, Massachusetts writes, "24 is a TV show. Of course the tactics work on the fictional characters that are tortured because it isn't real. If our West Point cadets think this show is something to emulate, I have to wonder how they got into school." And finally, our story on the Chinese government's efforts to take down signs around the country that featured boggled English, what the Chinese called Chinglish, sent Nathan Adams, a captain in the U.S. Army, on a trip down memory lane. He writes, "That brought back memories from my year spent serving in Iraq, where I discovered a similar phenomenon. It was fascinating that the Western alphabet held such a strong appeal for the people of non-Western descent. In the midst of the daily anxieties of combat, it was a welcome, lighthearted distraction. Two of our personal favorites were a woman's long-sleeved T-shirt that said across the front, 'Sportively enjoyable since 1975,' and a barbershop called Mahmed for Shave. Thanks for your resurrection of a great memory from a difficult year." As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, that sound you're hearing, it's people in the sports world saying, finally, for the first time in its 123-year history, the Wimbledon Tennis Championship will give equal pay to women and men through all rounds of the tournament. Joining us to talk about this and the rest of the news from the world of sports, only a game host, Bill Littlefield. One of those saying finally?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's long overdue, but better now than not at all.
It's the All England Club, which runs Wimbledon. They just made the announcement today. I mean, your thoughts on this? Because, you know, last year the difference between the women's champion and the men's was about, what, $50,000. They still both made over $1 million.
Yes, insignificant to them. Perhaps. Seriously significant to the most of the rest of
yes.
us.
Yes.
It's a kind of a comical situation because the same man who said this is only logical and this is a matter of principle and we've got to do this is the guy who for years had been saying, I can't see any reason why we should pay women the same prize money as men because the men are a bigger draw. You could certainly argue that as well, but he's suddenly seen the light. The scales have fallen from his eyes, or else Billie Jean King has been over there beating on the back of his head with a tennis racket.
Or else he saw, you know, like the Williams sisters, who to some of us are
quality
more interesting.
Quality tennis may have figured into
there
this
you go.
Exactly.
We are reminded, though, in researching this, deep research, that in the first time the women played at Wimbledon, the woman received a silver flower basket, and the man, and that was worth about 20 guineas, as they called it at the time, and the man got a gold prize worth 30. Mm-hmm. So there you go. It's always yes. been.
And not so very long ago, Billie Jean King got a silver plate full of Snickers bars and a spaghetti dinner paid for by Bud Collins.
That's right. Well, here in the States, we're starting to think about baseball, spring training in full swing. Big news here in Boston just came across. Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling announcing today that he's going to file for free agency after this season. Listeners who, I can't imagine why, are not following the Red Sox, you might have noticed he was the guy who won the World Series with mm-hmm. a bloody sock.
Yes, this is the best news to come out of spring training yet, because players who know they're going to be free agents at the end of a year frequently have magnificent years because there's money at stake. And if he really does intend to play beyond 2007 and offer his services to the highest bidder, then it is very much in his interests to create something very much worth bidding for.
Well, there's that. And I just wonder, you know, we've touched on some of the stories down at spring training. What are your favorites? I'm liking right now the fact that supposedly Yankee stars Alex Rodriguez and the captain Derek Jeter are fighting.
That's only a good story if they end up throwing baseballs at each other rather than to the appropriate base to get somebody out. And I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think this is going to be a story that plays out at all on the
darn.
Field, whatever it means. I do like the fact that Butch Hobson, former Red Sox manager, now managing the Nashua Pride up in New Hampshire, a minor league team, has signed Rich Garces, the flamboyantly large relief pitcher known as El Guapo, somewhat ironically, since Guapo means handsome. And he will be back in baseball, and that's good news for those of us who watch minor league ball here in New England.
Okay. Well, basketball, real quick. NBA had its All-Star game last week. Who do you see as the teams we should be watching in the second half of the season?
I love to watch Phoenix. I love to watch Dallas because they're both magnificently entertaining teams, teams stocked with shooters and teams that play fast and get from one end to the other very quickly, and those are the teams I like to watch. But it'll be fun to watch the Celtics to see whether they get the lottery pick, which is pretty much all that's left for them to play for at this point.
Yeah, if they can, you know, finish dead last. College basketball, you have a story coming up on the Badgers of Wisconsin for one shining moment
yes,
earlier this week.
The mighty Badgers ascended into the top spot for the first time in their history, and they got dizzy and probably will fall out of it unless they can beat Ohio State this weekend. But they were up there for a time, and it must have been very exciting.
Very exciting. And finally, we have to ask you about a Reuters story that we saw this morning about this past summer's World Cup causing a possible rise in birth rates in Germany, which we remember hosted the event.
It's a documented rise. The maternity wards are full in Germany. Robin,
yeah?
Soccer is exciting.
Oh, this is why you wanted this in here. You Anything you can point to your beloved sport being exciting.
Clear evidence. I rest my case.
Some might say it might have been the alcohol involved. But anyway, Only a Game host Bill Littlefield covers sports and a whole lot more every weekend on his program. Do not miss it. Bill, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
More ahead here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now. Big, exuberant, and sanctified, Sister Rosetta Tharpe sang at storefront churches, tent meetings, the Cotton Club, and the Grand Ole Opry in the 30s through the 70s. She held her third wedding in a packed baseball stadium, and they said she played guitar like a man.
Sit down, I told you. I can't sit down. No, I can't sit down. Then go away, don't bother me. I can't sit down because I just got to heaven and I can't sit down.
Sister Rosetta Tharpe was gospel's first internationally known star, before Mahalia, and she was there at the birth of rock and roll, leaving her mark on performers from Johnny Cash to Elvis Presley to Bonnie Raitt. But you can guess the end of the story. Sister Rosetta died poor, buried in an unmarked grave in Philadelphia. Well, Gail Wald now reminds us what was lost in her new book, Shout, Sister, Shout, The Untold Story of a Rock and Roll Trailblazer. And Gail joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. with more. Welcome.
Very nice to be here.
This is one of those pull someone back from, the unknown and tell their story. And again, many of us go, who knew?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was kind of my response when I first saw a videotape of Rosetta Tharpe about 10 years ago, which is what launched me on this project. I had heard of her, but it wasn't until I saw that videotape and saw the image of a woman who was rather conservatively dressed in a church setting playing electric guitar with a kind of confidence and exuberance and kind of rocking aesthetic that I just didn't associate with the church, that really got me interested in who this person was and why we didn't know more about her.
Well, wasn't associated with very many people at the time. Can you describe it? Because it's described in the book as being, literally the voice that a black woman couldn't have.
Rosetta Tharpe was brought up in a Pentecostal church called the Church of God in Christ, and like lots of Pentecostal denominations, that was one where women were kind of institutionally second-class citizens. They weren't allowed to preach in the institutional church. But at the same time, it was a church that gave women an awful lot of voice in other ways, and particularly through music. But Rosetta Tharpe found a way to speak through her voice and through her guitar.
Well, she moved from the church, though, in the 30s, made her way to Harlem, and played at the Cotton Club with Cab Calloway, played during the Harlem Renaissance, at a time when playing music to mixed audiences was a kind of glamour and opportunity beyond anything she could have imagined. Here's Sister Rosetta Tharpe with the Lucky Millinder Band from 1941 singing Shout, Sister, Shout.
Now listen, everybody, to the precious word. I'm gonna do some chirping, and I ain't no bird. That's a reason for living, a reason for dying, a darn good reason why a woman starts crying, a reason for a mole, a reason for a dimple, but there ain't no reason why a man's so simple.
Shout, sister, shout.
Later, she said she regretted leaving the church. How big a deal was that, to go from the church to that lifestyle?
You know, at that time, it would have been a very big deal. She was playing the revival circuit in Miami, Florida in 1936, 37, with her husband, who was a preacher, and then she made this incredible leap, really almost an overnight leap, to the Cotton Club, which was a club at that point that really had a kind of whites-only admissions policy at the door and was kind of the swankest place in New York City to play. And that was quite anathema to the teachings that she had grown up with in the church. But my sense was that this was a constant source of tension for her. I think that she had the ambition to play for wider audiences. She certainly had a gift of, knowing how to perform, and kind of she had a charisma on stage that's unmistakable when you see the images of her. And I think that clashed with the prevailing values of her church, but that she needed to go forward in that artistic direction. And I think she struggled with that, although I think in the end, you know, she appreciated the celebrity that she got, and she thrived on that.
Well, there are all these contradictions, because a church member early on says, you know, they did approve of really embracing music. I think you quote one church elder as saying something like, you know, why should the devil have all the beat? But on the other hand, you know, one of the reasons that she seemed to want to move into the secular life was because there was money to be made there. And she defended playing in the cafes because she said there were more souls to be saved there.
Yeah, you know, I think that's what a lot of gospel singers said when they moved, those who moved into secular sphere, they would often say that. My sense is that that was what she said for PR reasons, and that really it was this desire on the part of an entertainer to really speak to the biggest audience that she could, and she had an amazing appeal across boundaries of race and class and region.
I said it rained, you know it rained, oh, it rained, rained too long, now it rained, rained all day, rained all night, rained, rained, night rained, it rained.
Happened because, you know, as we said, she had several homes. She used to have sheds, separate sheds to keep her many gowns. She, one of her marriages, her third, I think it was in a baseball stadium in Washington, D.C., before tens of thousands, and she played the guitar in her wedding gown, and then buried poor and alone in Philadelphia. And you just wonder, does this have to be the ending for the African-American musical trailblazer, you know, whose sound is taken over by something else?
It's a combination of factors that led to kind of her anonymity. One thing is that musical tastes were changing, and as a middle-aged performer in the 1950s, she was confronting the rise of the youth market and the rise of rhythm and blues, and her label, Decca Records, was very eager in the mid-50s to try to get her to do a sound that would appeal to a younger audience. I don't know that her heart was really in that, but she was never able to kind of make that transition to kind of getting a youth audience in the U.S. On the other hand, she had a very big break in 1957. She went over to England, and she became a big hit overseas. And that's the story with a lot of blues singers who were popular in the 1930s or 40s in the U.S. And she had kind of a second career in Europe. Arguably, when she died in 1973, she was more well-known in Paris and London than she was in Philadelphia.
As we go out with some more music of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, this is her with her friend and collaborator Marie Knight and the Sammy Price Trio. It's Up Above My Head, I Hear Music in the Air. This is from 1947. Can you name artists of today who have actually been able to draw the line from their playing to her?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. When I did the research for this book, how many people said that she was an influence to them, and not just guitar players. The late, great Ruth Brown told me how important it was that Rosetta Tharpe got up there and did her thing, and that gave Ruth Brown, who grew up in the church and was a budding rhythm and blues singer, she said, the confidence to go up and sing anything that she liked. Ruth Brown, Etta James, Bonnie Raitt, Maria Muldaur, many of the musicians associated with the British invasion, Graham Edge of the Moody Blues, Johnny Cash, Elvis Presley, Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, a whole range of artists. And this is not even within the gospel field. So really her influence is deep and wide.
Well, Gail Wald tells us about it all in Shout, Sister Shout, the untold story of a rock and roll trailblazer. It is the story of Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Gail, thanks so much.
Thank you.
By the way, you can see the performance that inspired Gail Wald by going to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.